Dr. Nick Begich, well known for his work and research on mind effects, more of a sinister kind rather than the life-enhancing. He has widely reported these areas, has been an expert on many publications, government organizations, private companies. He's been an expert witness for the European Parliament on these kinds of subjects, providing significant research contributions. You also know him as the expert on HARP. Here he is, Nick Begich on Coast to Coast. Nick, how are you?
I'm great. It's good to be with you again, George.
You too. Full program with you. I'm looking forward to it. Been busy, I hear.
Always, always. It's just never ends. You know, just one thing leads to another, and you try and stay on top of it all.
I want to ask you a quick HARP question before we get into the human brain performance.
You bet.
Somebody wanted to know if we get hit with a EMP, electromagnetic pulse, maybe from the sun or from some nuke. Is HARP being designed to be able to withstand that, beaming signals back at it? Possible?
I just don't see where it's so relevant to the design. I mean, HARP is designed to take a, you know, to produce a pretty good bit of energy and to route a lot of energy. But I can tell you, you know, just some simple things. In the early tests of the system, there was a lightning strike on the facility, and it literally vaporized a lightning arrestor. You know, there's a possibility of arcing across the grid. You know, it actually may even concentrate energy from an EMP. I don't know that you could really shield the device so readily.
Okay. Now tell me about your work and research in the human brain.
Well, this area, you know, has always intrigued me. In fact, before I ever got involved with HARP, aspects of human mental performance, you know, was a big deal for me, and just sort of looking at some of the things that were going on in research. In fact, it was one of the very first things that caused me concern with HARP when we realized that it was, in fact, the largest radio transmitter ever designed for military applications, but it had one specific use that caused me concern, and it was the development of ELF waves, extremely low frequency wavelengths that would be used in the case of HARP, allegedly for communication with submarines and earth-penetrating tomography, or sort of looking into the earth applications where you needed this very long wavelength. But it just so happens that those very same pulse rates, those very same frequencies are involved in human brain function. And the ability of the human brain to sort of mirror those outside impulses and then, of course, have corresponding chemical changes and changes even in behavior as a result from that, that's what caused me, I think, more than anything else to start looking at HARP as perhaps a bigger, more invasive system than what was originally reported. And of course, you know, since that time, we've delved into a lot of research surrounding this very topic of mind effects.
You know, this article I was reading from Wired Magazine to introduce you, the military is dead serious, aren't they, about using electronic telepathy?
Yeah, and actually it goes back a very, very long time. This article that just came out is just a little brief, a couple of column inches, really. When you stop and think about the subject, they are looking for a method to create silent talk or battlefield telepathy for communication purposes without using vocalized speech, without using normal transmission systems for communication. They believe that by analyzing the human brain, that we can come up with some generalizations about brain patterns that are directly linked to specific thoughts, then be able to analyze those thoughts and literally read each other's minds at a distance. And when I say the work goes back, I mean, what the military is headed for at this point is a very involved system of analysis that's going to be computer heavy. But back in the mid-1980s, there was work being done by electrophysiologists in the United States and an electrical engineer, where they were able to create a form of electronic telepathy without an analysis of brain patterns, just by recognizing sort of the underlying mechanism for how thoughts are generated, the kinds of signals they produce, and then how to interpret those signals at a distance.
How mad science is that, the DARPA division for the Pentagon?
Well, I mean, they do all of the really wild, and for those of us following this stuff, the more interesting research. But it's not just confined to DARPA. The Navy has its own programs. Air Force has its own programs in the Army and Marines as well, in these same general areas. But DARPA tends to take the lead, at least on some of these more far-out sort of concepts. The reality is, you know, today's science fiction, you know, may in fact be tomorrow's science fact. In fact, I saw a really interesting quote in the last couple of days dealing with this issue. And, you know, it goes back to, you know, what we think of as magic might in fact just be leading edge science. And if we look back in history, we can certainly see that.
I find it interesting that the military has gone from its old remote viewing program to something like this, a little more high-tech, but nonetheless still dabbling in the supernatural, can we say, or the paranormal?
Sure. In fact, the quote I was looking for was Arthur C. Clarke, and it says, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And this is, you know, this type of science is not new. As I said, it's been around for a very long time. Sort of understanding the brain and what is possible has always been a big part of military research. When you go back to some of the mind control experiments that everybody's heard about, I'm sure most Coast listeners have heard about the MKUltra programs and these older programs, but one of the things that sort of underlies all of those issues, and people kind of jump to the conclusion, well, this is controlling, this is manipulating people. But I think one of the other things they discovered, and in talking to some of the researchers in the area, I'm convinced more so now than ever, is they discovered what was behind sort of the human capacity to do what the military calls anomalous human functions, which used to just simply call ESP, extrasensory perception. But I think that's what was really discovered. And in discovering that, probably the greatest concern was raised in military circles was if man reached our highest and full potentials in this area, maybe we become the ultimate weapon. So sort of mirroring some of the things that have been observed, psychic research, looking at the stuff the Soviets were doing, and now a lot of that has been declassified and available. This goes back many, many decades, 50, 60 years at a minimum.
How far advanced is the military now?
I think that they have the ability, certainly, to influence human behaviors generally, to transfer sound information like us talking now, but doing it in a way that's very direct to an individual. In fact, Woody Norris won the MIT Lemelson Prize for that in 2005. And we've been saying that that technology, maybe not using acoustic heterodyning as Woody Norris was using, but the technology has been around for a very long time in different forms. And this is the idea of transferring sound directly into the brain of an individual at a distance without any physical contact, no implants, no ancillary devices. And that's what Woody Norris had done. We demonstrated back in 1998 a device of a similar nature, but it required physical contact with the human body. And we made that demonstration for the European Parliament in a committee hearing, and as a result, we were able to get a resolution passed, a section incorporated in a resolution that was passed that deals with this whole idea of manipulation of human beings electronically or artificially.
What's the goal, Nick? What are they trying to accomplish?
Well, I think a couple of things. Firstly, sort of the ultimate communication system in real time, if you could, in fact, utilize a system like electronic telepathy, then you sort of you speed up the process of communication, and you also make sure that your communication is accurately understood because you can analyze all of that the way the system is being contemplated. The other is influence of your adversaries. The idea of overriding your adversary's brain function has been, you know, the ultimate command and control is to take control of your adversary directly. And you know, then all the hardware and all machinery and all the equipment, doesn't matter what you have if you don't have an operator. And so I think that's, you know, sort of part of the target. The other part is our own enhanced capability. And then I think part of it is perhaps even to suppress some of these capabilities that human beings from time to time can demonstrate.
I had heard the military was working on a mind-reading binocular.
Right. That's part of the idea there as well, is to be able to look through a glass. You know, and what you're doing is you're essentially focusing in on the target, but the electronics is actually looking at what's going on in the other person's brain and giving you some feedback.
Amazing.
And to be able to do that remotely.
It's truly amazing, Nick.
Well, the idea they're doing it, they're spending good money on it, and it's, you know, it's a, you know, in military expenditures, these are $4 million expenditures for first some of the early work done at the University of California, and then another $4 million to try and get this thing advanced a little further. But if you go back to 9/11, in a magazine that I'm sure nobody reads, it's called Signal Intelligence.
Nobody reads.
But this publication suggested that that we develop a metal detector-looking device, but it actually would detect gross brain activity. So they could tell, like, for instance, at an airport you'd pass through the device, and it wouldn't be looking at for metal and guns. It would be looking at your mental state to decide whether you're agitated, nervous, fearful, to look at those parts of the brain that are sort of lit up to determine, you know, sort of what lines up with what a terrorist might be experiencing at that moment.
Now, someone could be nervous because they're just simply flying, right?
Right, and a lot of people are. In fact, more people than care to admit do have a underlying fear of flying, or you know, or they're going to, you know, things like funerals and marriages and important events where there's a lot of high emotion going on. And so the idea of making mistakes is certainly there, but the idea behind this new Pentagon program is to refine that to the point where words, thoughts, those kinds of things are interpreted. Now, the problem, if it doesn't become obvious really quickly, a lot of things are thought but not acted upon. I mean, all of us have thoughts that we don't act upon. In fact, most of our thinking we probably don't act upon. In the course of a day, you know, we just have fleeting thoughts, ideas, daydreams, what have you. Yet, should those, the real question is, should those be subject to interpretation by a third party? Should they be something that the government feels they have the right to delve into?
The machinery used to read, let's say, the mind, could that get in the hands of the wrong people, and how could they use it against us?
Certainly. In fact, I mean, you can only imagine in business exchanges where you're trying to negotiate something, if the other party had access to your data, literally, right out of your brain, a distinct advantage would be present there. The commercial applications, for a lot of different reasons, for marketing, for selling, for knowing what sort of turns a person off mentally, that kind of work, in fact, is already being done. I mean, where people are looking at brain activity in real time. In fact, gamers are using software now for this so that they can, you know, instead of getting the feedback sort of after the game is run by interviewing the participants,
right,
by watching the brain in real time, you can see exactly what's stimulated, which games stimulate what parts of the brain and at what higher levels, and which get the big adrenaline charges by monitoring the body and the mind. And so when you start to look at sort of what else goes on in the neurosciences, these are where these huge advances that are being made, not just in military circles, but in the private side as well, need to be considered in light of personal privacy in the 21st century, because it is no longer ending at the doorway to your home. It is a digital doorway to everything you are and everything you do.
And the equipment is going to be necessary to do this, or will they be able to train people to do it without the equipment?
Well, now this is interesting because I think what's happening is we develop equipment to sort of replicate what human beings maybe naturally can do. The area of telepathy comes up in military literature a lot. The idea of being able to train the mind to do this, I think, is possible once you have a clear understanding of how the mechanism works. And that's where the neurosciences and computer sciences, as they're advancing, are giving us the capability of perhaps doing exactly that.
If they're using it to test for communication via telepathy, and if the military has it, they've got to then be using this for some other reason too, Nick. You know, maybe to try to assassinate someone via the brain, something like that?
That's possible, I suppose. But more importantly, you know, I think someone to be alive and being able to manipulate them on a subtle level where they don't perceive the manipulation could be even more useful. I mean, imagine a national leader who thought he was hearing the voice of God, as an example. And that's not so far-fetched because of technology.
Some leaders do think they're hearing the voice.
Right, some of them do. But the idea is that perhaps a private party or a governmental entity from another government could create that same illusion and maintain it in such a way as to make that national leader act in certain ways.
A Manchurian candidate.
Absolutely. And the ability to create the Manchurian candidate today is much, much different than it was, say, 40, 50 years ago when work was actually being done in this area. A guy named Estabrooks was creating what we would call today the Manchurian candidate using hypnotherapy over an extended period of time and being able to create a completely synthetic personality. It took 9 to 10 months to do this. The idea was to create a super spy that could be sent in into an adversary's territory, could function for some period of time without detection, and if they were detected, they would have no memory of their former self unless they were given that hypnotic cue that brought them back. And Estabrooks, in his work in this area, and he was a profound researcher in the area, what he was able to do in this was with about 20% of his test subjects, bring them into such a profound state of hypnosis that they could achieve that kind of real program. Today, it could be done much more effectively, augmenting electronic technologies that are available today to put people into those deep, deep trance-like states and then load them up with whatever programming a person would want to load them up with.
What companies are working on this? I'm sure they're being contracted out, right?
Well, most of this is probably contracted. I think all of your major organizations in military research, have probably been involved in some component of it. But most of this research is pretty compartmentalized. You'll see bits and pieces of it. You'll see, and for instance, you'll see contracts for specific antenna designs for broadcasting or receiving signals like this. You'll see other contracts for neurological research to understand more about the brain and the modeling of the brain. Then you'll see research in development design of electronic substrates to replicate those kinds of signals. So you get it spread over, virtually all of the major military manufacturers end up one way or another getting a piece of it. I mean, even if you look at a program like even going back to HAARP, HAARP started as a oil and gas company's project that then migrated to a university military project and then migrated to a military contractor's project and then migrated to another contractor's project. You know, eventually ended up in British Aerospace, but it went from E-Systems to Raytheon to British Aerospace, and yet all the technology stayed intact. They just got sort of handed off to various operators by selling off a subsidiary. And much in the same way do these kind of programs operate. The other thing that people need to know is once you farm it out to corporations, they're not subject to the Freedom of Information Act. So you have the ability to mask the research projects.
That's a very good point. And I assume if they're able to do things like this, read minds, can they also then force people, individuals, to obey?
Well, this is sort of the next the next step in the technology as the Pentagon's playing it out in this Wired article. However, if you go back, the idea of doing this has been done before, and I think that's maybe when we get back from the music. When we get back, we can talk about what they did.
Absolutely, what a way to control the human mind. Nick, let's get into the possibilities then of how they can control people's minds.
Well let's talk a little bit about some of the things that can be done now. I mean, just by broadcasting voice information at just below the level of conscious hearing, you can actually inject the information into the brain in a pretty dramatic way. In fact, virtually any electromagnetic carrier can be used for influencing, gross behavior, emotional states, as an example. Whether you use light, flickering light, sound, or current, you can create pulsations that the mind will lock onto in what's called a frequency following response, or an FFR. And what happens is these external signals then change your emotional state. So they can make you more lethargic or more aggressive, or put you in that sort of semi-awake, semi-asleep sort of state where you're very easily influenced. In fact, I believe some of this already goes on now. I mean, when you think about people coming home from work at the end of a hard day, people are fatigued. Generally, most people end up at some point or another in the evening sitting in front of a television set.
Yep.
They're very relaxed at that point. They're kind of decompressing the day.
And then they get the radio for the late show.
That's right. That's right. And what happens is when you're sitting there staring at that television screen, the advertisers, if they understand the frequency following response, and it's taught in most master's level psychology courses, you'll start to learn about this, that you can literally control the flicker rate of a commercial screen that will put someone in a much more relaxed, suggestive state.
Almost like a trance.
Almost like a trance. And if you've tried to wake your kids up, if you've got kids, you know, when they're staring at the TV and you get their attention, you're right next to them, it is almost like a trance. They're totally focused. But what you can then do with the overt commercial advertisement, just speak the words like you normally would, where they're audible, but your state has been affected by the flicker rate on the screen. You can also use any electromagnetic carrier. In fact, it was a Russian military journal, Orienteer, that published an article on this. It was later picked up by Perimeters, the U.S. Army War College Quarterly, and they talked about the same kind of thing. They talked about psychotronic generators, which could produce electromagnetic emanations that would be capable of being sent through any, virtually any carrier, telephone lines, TV, radio networks, all of those kinds of things. And then anyone who's in close contact with those signals would be influenced by them. And we're talking about just emotional states. There was work also done at Laurentian University in this area by Persinger, who believed that you could create complex radio signals that could be broadcast over huge areas that would create, for instance, a sense of disease or discomfort, some sort of sense of worry, and then do something as overt as on the 6 o'clock news, just indict a specific group of people of being responsible for all of your ills, and just naturally, most of us would turn a great deal of that emotional energy towards that that group or that target. It could be as simple as that, or much more complicated.
A study by the Iowa University back in November of last year reported that on video games, children who did in Japan and the United States who practiced and played with violent video games showed an increased risk for aggression and violence. That's controlling the mind, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and it's a couple of things happen. You desensitize people. If you just think about television over our lifetimes, George, and it's gone from, pretty passive and simplistic.
Leave it to Beaver, right?
Right. To reality-based movie production that is so real in what they can do now with illusion that if you took it back 50 years, people would have heart attacks in movie theaters. It'd be so real. But it's kind of worked its way in to our culture, and so, you don't have those same kind of reactions. I remember when The Exorcist came out, and that was such a dramatic change in film, in terms of the quality of film. People were passing out in movie theaters. There was all kinds of things going on that had never really been reported before. And, you kind of can look at that as sort of one of those benchmarks where the film industry recognized maybe their full potential in terms of what they could do. But a lot of it had to be integrated in over time. And that is a form of mind control or conditioning. Video games, they not only pick up the reflexes of an individual, but they also desensitize. And when you think about modern warfare, isn't it a lot like a video game? I mean, we can now...
Sure.
We can launch an aircraft and control it from the Midwest, and we can control an aircraft in Iraq that could devastate a large number of people. But, you go home at night and get up in the morning and have your coffee. Big difference.
Those movies that Harrison Ford starred in, those Patriots, the Patriot and things like that, Patriot Games, I think.
Right.
depicted satellite imagery attacking, let's say, places in the Middle East. And they sat back at the Pentagon and just witnessed what was happening. That's real, isn't it?
Yes, it is. The ability to visually see anything on this planet today, count the numerals on the data on the dime. These kinds of things we have these capabilities now. They've advanced dramatically. In fact, it used to be just during daylight. Now we can see quite a bit, even in the night, just by heat signatures and the differences heat radiating from various objects. You can pick things out. There's a lot of technology now that even allows us to look under the earth, several kilometers deep, and perhaps even several hundred feet deep, and distinguish temperature variances of several hundred feet underground that would distinguish, for instance, a machine versus a human being based on temperature.
Wasn't there a Japanese video game that made kids sick?
Right. It was actually not a video game. It was actually a cartoon.
That's right.
Right. It was aired on Japanese television. In fact, it was interesting. It was just a few months before I testified in the European Parliament on these subjects back in 1998. And it was fresh enough where parliamentarians remembered it. 700 children went to the hospital having experienced epileptic seizures, which is a well-known phenomenon that's possible to be triggered by flickering light, which is why epileptics can't go around strobe lights or these kinds of lighting situations.
Gave them seizures, didn't it?
Right. And the same is true, it's essentially a frequency following response that they're a little bit more sensitive in that particular part of the brain. But the idea that a cartoon harmlessly been broadcast across the airwaves had this profound effect. And we're all told, of course, that just sit back 10 feet from your TV, everything's okay. It's not the amount of energy being dissipated, it's what the energy can do. And that's where the neuroscience and the electronics have sort of met each other, and the technology is now advancing rather rapidly.
To control populations, will they be able, we understand and we know that they are working on weaponry, which will bring people down to their knees with sound.
Right.
But will they be able to beam things to people's brains and literally just make them crumble?
Well, this is, this is in fact part of the science that has been developed. The idea that you can create, Woody Norris did this with heterodyning, not just for transferring voice as like sort of warning systems, but also high-pitched sounds, sounds that would be very uncomfortable. The other things that have been done by others is broadcasting ELF signals that interact with the body in such a way as it causes a person to release their bowels. Now, if you're in a combat situation, you just become
soiled.
Soiled, difficult to concentrate and focus, and certainly you're disadvantaged. Or if you're rioting in the streets, the riots come to an end in a hurry. The idea that this kind of technology would be used not just in military conflicts, but domestically, is not only a reality, it was actually a priority in the 1980s. And we traced this in some of our earlier work in the 80s to the 90s. We showed how the Department of Justice, in cooperation with the Department of Defense, were actually involved in some of these technology transfers. In fact, this whole classification of weapons are put under that classification of non-lethal, which means that theoretically they don't kill anyone. And Department of Justice really wanted access to some of those non-lethal systems for use domestically as opposed to, more lethal systems, which, we can understand. One of the things that they had said in the early reports on this was that they wanted to make sure it was open to the public and everything was above board so that undue suspicion wouldn't be generated. The very next meeting, which was done at one of the major medical institutions, John Hopkins, was actually a classified conference where Department of Justice and DOD did get together, but the public wasn't included. The topics for discussion were the kinds of things we're talking about tonight.
Nick, what about other countries? They must be working on this too.
Absolutely. In terms of the former Soviet Union and Russia today, this was a big area for them, one that they were very interested in, had spent a good deal of money on. In fact, on our website, we have a number of Russian publications that were declassified going back to the 60s and 70s, discussing their work in telepathy, telekinesis, basically the parapsychology efforts of the Soviets. And they were looking for weapons applications as well as their own troop enhancements.
Now, working on altered states as well, you call it frequency following response, right?
Right.
Tell me more about that.
Well, this is interesting because, you know, on the private side, there's always been interest in sort of looking at, you know, what can you do to enhance human performance?
Sure.
Can we get our, you know, what kinds of things can we do? And many people, you know, going back to where it was almost a fad, meditation and concentration exercises in the 60s were a big deal. But what people were really looking for were several things: enhanced relaxation, enhanced meditation, altered states of consciousness, which, of course, the whole drug scene emerged out of that one. The idea of enhancing memory or learning capacities. In other words, looking at what can the brain do and how do I exercise that organ in a way that will make it more effective. And so a lot of things were looked at. In this frequency following response, it was discovered that light could be used to drive the brain into specific desired states. Like some people would want to get into a highly meditative state that they might have to train for 10, 20 years to reach that state. Using neurobiofeedback and some flickering instruments, you could actually drive a person to those states, and they could learn how to do it themselves within a month, it has been reported, instead of 10 or 20 years. And the reason was because they didn't just drive the brain into these specific states, but they also used neurobiofeedback as a way to sort of learn how to do it yourself. And it goes back to that earlier question of, you know, could we learn how to do this ourselves in terms of mental telepathy? I think the answer to that is yes. And I think time will prove me absolutely right on this.
Sure.
That it is something that people will be able to train to once we have a clear understanding of how the brain affects this kind of a response.
There is no question that our abilities to do these incredible things are in different areas of the brain. Science, has it pinpointed where?
I think they have to a large extent, and there's probably more classified on this particular topic than a lot of the others, but the brain has been mapped pretty thoroughly, and anomalous, unusual people have been studied to look at sort of what parts of the brain light up when the mystic is doing his work, and the person with predictive capacities or telepathic capacities are doing their work. And by looking at the brain in real time, we can gain an understanding. And what's happened now is computer modeling and three-dimensional imaging of neurological functions is becoming much, much more sophisticated, where our ability to sort of get the image as it's happening is now here. Now, getting the complete neurological networking is going to take a bit more computing power, but I think we're on the verge of that. Quantum computing leaps that we're about to make are going to take us to a place where we can not only map the brain, but we could then create complex signals that would duplicate those brain patterns in other people to see what happens.
And
that's where the research
is. Nick, there's got to be a time, too, where they get to the point where they train people how to do telekinesis, how to move objects with one's thought patterns.
Yeah, I think this is where it all heads. In fact, you know, we did a conference when I was working with the Millay Institute. We did a conference on mind effects, and we brought together, you know, a number of people for that conference. And what was truly amazing to me, and these were all folks I'd known for at least 10 years, in the sidebar conversations and in one open, couple of open presentations, that was sort of the next evolution. Rosalie Bertel's presentation, she's an outstanding physicist. She was also taught advanced mathematics at, I think it was Berkeley University back in the 60s and 70s, very brilliant individual, and her presentation was essentially sort of the next leap is mankind reaching this state of awareness where we're actually in touch with these capabilities of the military in low-intensity conflict and modern technology. There's a chapter in there where they're actively pursuing some of this. When you start to think about major scientists talking about this issue, another one, Alexander Kavaranen, who was in our conference. Alex, I've known for a number of years. He used to run the biophysics lab at the USSR Academy of Sciences, and he had done a formulation on telepathy and a number of these other areas. And the interesting thing was he broke it down into a mathematical formula to explain it. This is how it works, and here's the formula. And he lays it out pretty matter-of-factly. And Alex, a brilliant individual in this area, probably one of the top 10 biophysicists in the world. But when you start to look at sort of the mainstream of science, taking a hard look at it, and as a theoretical physicist, Alex, could understand it, break it down into the mathematics, but take that and engineer it into a device that could do it. That's the next evolution. And I think it's probably, in real terms, I think it's probably already been advanced quite a bit, not just in the United States, but this area in Russia, in the former Soviet Union. I believe this area has been advanced. There's interest, of course, by all sophisticated governments in this area for all differing reasons, some for manipulation, some for defense purposes. But ultimately, the temptation is what gets in the way of good judgment. And that's where I get, again, concerned. Whether it's liberals or conservatives in control of this technology, the temptation to use it becomes much, much too great. In fact, it was Zbigniew Brzezinski that suggested it in almost those same words back now almost 40 years ago in a book called Between Two Ages when he was at Columbia University. And what he said was that these technologies would emerge, and when they did, the rationale for using them, whether it was a liberal or a conservative rationale, the temptation would be huge and probably not avoidable by a national leader, which again sort of gets back to, what do we do with technology when we're sitting here perhaps past the verge where we're already well into it on several levels? What do we do in the course of this century to regulate these technologies and to recognize the risks associated with them, whether they be privately held or held by governments?
Does the research show that some people are more susceptible to this than others, or able to do it better than others?
I think it does show that. In fact, all of the literature that we read, like when you talk about mass effects, where you can affect a whole population by broadcasting a signal, what all of the literature says is about 70% of the people would be subordinated to it. 30% wouldn't.
More to come, Nick, when we come right back. Nick's website, by the way, earthpulse.com. Nick, is science agreeing that something exists in the universe to allow us to communicate this way via telepathy, or are they simply saying it's a product of the brain?
I think they're saying it's a product of the brain, and I think we do communicate in this way. In fact, I think this is probably our natural state of communication, and the words sort of get in the way. I've had a couple of experiences personally that were pretty profound to convince me of that. And you can't quantify it so readily, but having had some experiences myself, I go, maybe this is in fact the way that we really communicate. Why is communication quality so much better when you're sitting in front of a person? Is it body language? Is it facial expressions? Is it tone? Or is it something more than that? And I think it's the more than that. I think underlying all communication is this ability to communicate at this level, which I think we do naturally. Some people at a really refined level, and they trust it. They call it just their intuition. Others, more overtly, I've met individuals that had telepathic capacity that was profound, impossible to explain in any other way except to say profound. And the individual, a friend of mine who had had this sort of ongoing capacity, it was a curse for him.
Why?
Well, every time he was with, and it would take, he'd have to be in a relaxed state in order for it to kick in. And he would get into a relaxed situation, maybe having a couple of drinks with friends, and he would automatically start reading their sort of inner thoughts, you know, what they were thinking about him at the moment. Became pretty disheartening when you find out what really rolls through your supposed friend's mind as they're having a conversation with you. And, you know, in one level, I said this before, you know, that most things that people think, they don't necessarily speak. You know, it's a matter of how we moderate our behavior, but you think a lot of things randomly. To have the ability where you're picking it up randomly, I don't think is necessarily a good thing. And he was an example of it. In fact, I lost touch with him for a number of years, and I started talking about him, you know, in some of my conversations about this topic. And when I tracked him back down, he was working in a daycare center with children, young children, preschoolers.
Interesting.
Which made perfect sense to me. I mean, when you think about innocent thoughts and yet you have this capacity, you can kind of direct kids in a pretty responsible way without being too invasive. And children's thoughts are pretty harmless in most cases. But it was a curse for him. And the interesting part is this wasn't something he had from birth. I had gone to high school with him. I had seen him after high school, and it was during the interim.
He developed it.
He gained the capability, but his was trauma-based, which is not unusual either. He had gone through an emotional upset, a very significant one for him. After that, he had had a spontaneous out-of-body experience, which he couldn't explain. And from that point forward, he had this capacity. Now, what happened to sort of rewire his circuits in that trauma, and this maybe became sort of a survival kind of capacity, so he wouldn't get hurt again. The brain works in pretty unusual ways, and for him, this was the case. But when you read, and at one point in my life, I read a lot in terms of this area, and trauma triggering these kinds of events. It's not so unusual.
You know, a couple, for example, that clicks, they get along, they have a good relationship. They've got this ability to communicate sometimes without speaking.
Absolutely. In fact, you can look in, you hear that phrase, and I looked into her eyes.
And you knew.
And you knew. Well,
you're not going to sing for us now.
Well, I won't do that. But the thing is, when you do that, when you lock a gaze with an individual and you hold it, what will happen is if you measure both people's brain activity, and if they're people that are compatible personalities, people who are in love particularly, their brains will sync up. In other words, you'll look into her eyes, and literally your brains within a very short period of time will begin to synchronize. They'll begin to literally pulse at the same rate.
Yet I don't particularly want to be able to read her mind.
No, but what you'll get is you get those general feelings, and they're pretty accurate.
The intuitive part.
Oh, yeah, and that's what you're reacting to, and you're rationalizing it, because that's what we do as humans. We try to put it all into words and put it into a framework so it fits in a nice, neat little box. But occasionally, the box gets broken open, and this is, again, where we see it's in trauma or on the opposite side of that, high positive emotions can sometimes unleash these capacities.
I know, like, for example, in producer Tom's case, if he's on a special date, if he were reading her mind, she'd be thinking, is he going to pick up the check or not? Is he going to spend it?
You're going to give Tom a hard time.
I do. He's up there. He's just fuming back there.
Well, see.
Well, what can he do?
Well, if you were the military, you'd be trying to figure out a way to make her pick up the check.
That's true. And they would be able to.
And they'd be able to. But, you know, when you're looking at all of this, and as we think about all of this, and the idea that the mind perhaps, and I believe it does, and I think there's very credible scientists now that are stepping up a little bit to this issue. Now we see DARPA sort of engaging the research community into stepping up a little bit more. I think we need to be careful because, you know, the mind and the thoughts that each of us have that we end up wrestling with internally and eventually formalizing into behaviors that we consider acceptable and in line with our value systems, you know, that's part of being human. And I think when we start to look at you know, analyzing people's activity in their brain to determine what they're thinking or what they might do is some dangerous ground. And because might and do are two very, very different things.
Good point. Let's go to St. Louis, east of the Rockies. Is this you, Vicki?
You knew I was going to call, didn't you, John?
I did.
Happy birthday.
Thanks, Vicki. Appreciate it. That's my night now, Nick.
All right.
June 4th.
Congratulations.
It's rolled in. But that's
59.
Not just why. It's
59.
Oh, you got it. You got it down. Been listening to me for about 12 years now.
Yeah. I remember your 50th.
Yeah, that's right. Anyway, you got a question for Nick?
Well, I have a story, George, about my brother. He was in the Navy. He retired after 20 years, and he was having a lot of anxiety and depression, and he was having problems with his ear all the time, and he kept going to the Navy doctors, and they couldn't see anything and looking in his ear. So then when he got out, he went to this Vietnamese doctor, ear specialist, and he got in there with a camera real deep. And he says, "What the heck you put in your ear?" And my brother said, "I didn't put anything in my ear." And here they pulled out, and he pulled on an implant. It was, had little microchips on it.
And does he think it was alien implanted or some other?
Well, when I listened to Dr. Lear, he says the ones with microchip are usually military.
Yeah.
So that's why I was thinking it was something military.
Nick, have you heard of this?
Yeah, you know, I was I lectured with Dr. Lear in New Zealand a year or two ago, and you know, he had some great material on this. And you know, the implanted technologies are a little more specific; they have different capabilities. What we are really talking about is maybe a crude form of influence if you were to use implants. You know, in the sense it'd be like looking at the old-style computers that filled up rooms and now fill up a wristwatch. And I think we're talking about the same kinds of things here. The technology shifts. It's like when Delgado was doing his initial work in the brain, mapping the brain, figuring out what all was going on within the brain when he was at Yale. And then he used implants to sort of trigger responses in animals to make them do certain things or have or experience certain emotional states. And he required implants. But by the mid-1980s, he was able to just modulate radio frequency signals, affect those very specific parts of the brain, and create the same effect with no implants whatsoever. And that's kind of the evolution as it's happened. We found that, you know, we can do this at a distance by stimulating very specific parts of the brain. The thing about Delgado is using the radio frequency signals he used, it wasn't the intensity. In fact, the intensity of the signal was reported to be 1/50th of the radio frequency background noise that the Earth naturally produces, which is 1/10 billionth of the radio frequency noise, if you will, that surrounds us right now in this instant with what man creates. So you're being able to pick out 1/1,000,000,000th of the energy intensity, if you will, and the mind, the brain is capable of knowing that that's the signal, or we're that fine of a tuning instrument where we can pick that signal out of that soup, if you will. So the brain is much more capable, and we are much more capable as transducers of complicated signals than we think. And this is, you know, when you talk about quantum computers, and we just briefly mentioned that during the last segment, and a quantum computer, and I've used this on your show before, and it's an important analogy, a supercomputer today, the biggest ones we have today, do about 280 teraflops a second, which is equal to all the people on the planet Earth with a hand calculator, each of us, every 5 seconds doing a calculation for 60 hours, and we'll do what a supercomputer does in a second. Imagine that supercomputer today running for 1 trillion years. Mm. A quantum computer will do the same thing in 1 hour. Now, I think that the human brain may, in fact, be a quantum computer. It takes 3 supercomputers today, all strung together, to follow 1 neuron firing chain in the human brain in 3 dimensions.
Isn't that amazing?
And yet, think about how complicated every one of our brains is. Everyone listening to this broadcast is literally a supercomputer. In fact, some would say that when Christ came here, it was to remind us of what our birthrights were as created human beings. You know, some people believe that. I personally believe that. I think that when you look at the example of having that kind of capacity as a created human being, and demonstrating it. And then his statement to everybody was, hey, you know, everybody else can do this too. In fact, a whole lot more than what I'm doing. And I think it was a message to all of us that says, hey, wake up to what your capacity is. But as we do it, we better do it wisely. And what we see man always doing is trying to duplicate what is natural with man-made apparatus, whether it's to fly a plane like a bird or whether it's to do some of the other things that we've done as human beings.
Okay, let's go to Las Vegas. Nick, you're on with Nick.
Yes, hi. I'm calling because I just wanted to know if you are using these technologies to read people's minds and alter people's activities, obviously it's altering their reality as to what they're doing while they're awake. It must certainly be altering what they're doing while they're sleeping. And either way, it's altering their normal way of thinking. And whether you're altering it, their way of thinking in a good way or a negative way, you're altering what's normal, and I would assume that would have a negative effect no matter which way you're doing it.
I think you're right. I think that human beings are meant to experience the full breadth of human emotions, independent of external influences that directly push us a certain way. I mean, being convinced with words and discussion and logic where the consciousness of our minds is fully engaged is one thing. But this is an imposition. And I had somebody ask me in a lecture once, wouldn't it be great if we could just make everybody happy? And the answer is no. In fact, I think anyone with any years behind them would say that the most important lessons or things that they've learned in life were learned in the unhappy moments. Unfortunately, it's the way most of us have learned some of the most important things in life.
Anya, Salt Lake City, first-time caller. Hello there.
Hi.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. How are you?
I'm good. Go ahead.
I think that I'm under surveillance and that I get personal messages from the radio. But my question is, I'm wondering if they have the technology to make you hear and see things. Because last August, out of the blue, I started hearing voices and seeing things, and it was just for one day that I saw things, but ever since then, I've been hearing voices, and I'm taking high doses of antipsychotics, and I'm still hearing voices.
What are these voices telling you, Anya?
The first day I took, I'm not on drugs. I never took any drugs. I just,
What are they saying to you, though?
First day, they were giving me commands. They were telling me that I was going to hell. They told me they were threatening me, and they told me to take off my clothes and walk down the street naked, and I did because they were telling me.
And you did?
Yes, they were threatening me that if I didn't do it, that all these horrible, scary things would happen to me.
Did you get arrested?
No, I was taken to the hospital.
Okay, how are you doing now?
Now they don't tell me to do crazy, stupid things anymore. Now they just mimic my thoughts.
Well, that's good. Now, Nick, there have been some cases people believe that they're getting bombarded by sources from out there.
Right, and I, you know, actually, I get a lot of inquiries because of the nature of the topics I've covered over the years, and there are a lot of people concerned about this. And in fact, I was in a conversation with a staff assistant for a senator in New York earlier today, a state senator who had several constituents inquiring about this very same thing, and trying to figure out how to sort that out. And the difficulty is with what this woman has just explained is you can't really sort it out so readily. The first response is medicate them. You know, they're schizophrenic or they have psychological disorders. And in most cases, that may very well be the case. However, the idea that this technology exists today makes all of these cases suspect, where we at least need to analyze them. And the problem is there's no real simple way to do this. And so sorting it out becomes a bit of a challenge. What I have said to victims or people that purport to be victims is the first challenge is convincing the general public and political leadership that the technology exists. Once that's sufficiently accomplished, the questions of who were the experimental subjects can legitimately be raised. In fact, I think they should be raised as it relates to the MKUltra and the earlier experiments that have already been acknowledged by government. I think there should be a full accounting of all of the experimental subjects in the early programs that have already been acknowledged by government to find out what happened to them. I can tell you what one of the MKUltra victims, according to the New York Times, he became the Unabomber. And he was at
Ted Kaczynski.
That's right. When he was at Harvard University as a student, he was participated in the MKUltra program.
Yep.
And, you know, if you remember, he struck out against academics, and he did it with this low-tech kind of mail bomb.
Was Tim McVeigh also in this program?
I don't know the answer to that. I've heard, you know, people assert that, but I don't know the answer to that. But, you know, this is why finding out who were the experimental victims and what became of them, what did they do in life, how did it affect them.
And were they told to do what they did?
Exactly right. And were they sleepers? Were they sent out there to cause problems and to see if they could actually be driven?
As an experiment.
And given the history of our government and other governments, that would not surprise me. In fact, it would surprise me if they didn't do that.
God, that's frightening. Stay with us, Nick. More phone calls to come right here on Coast to Coast AM. Nick, how far advanced do you think these DARPA experiments have gone?
Well, I think what's indicated, just in the fact that they've moved it along, they've been convinced enough to spend some money. I think they've had the capability of affecting emotional states for now a couple of decades. The idea of affecting specific ideas, words, thoughts, that's what's out there right now. There's even an RFP on the street presently that doesn't expire until September this year. It's been out for actually 3 years, and it's by the Air Force.
An RFP, request for proposals.
Right, where they're asking the contracting community to come forward with ideas that would allow better brain modeling, better analysis. It's one of those components that's really needed. And we have a convergence of technologies now that is unprecedented. I mean, the convergence of computer science, biological sciences, and electronics, as an example, to create brand new possibilities. I mean, the Salk Institute was able to grow brain cells on electronic substrate back in the late 1990s, and by the turn of the century, had figured out how to grow neurons to link those brain cells together. Well, that's sort of the biological computer being hooked up to electronics so that it can interface ultimately with either machine or man. That's where it's headed. And perhaps, having said that, that's where also the danger and the challenges lie because, you know, like anything, I mean, an airplane can take you to your next vacation or can drop bombs on your house, depends on the operator. And I think the same is going to be true as we get into the neurosciences and we learn more about the human capability. The question will become is, you know, who should have the capability? Who should develop it naturally? You know, it kind of comes, by trial, by error, by a lot of other ways. But if we could impose, say, mental telepathy on people, is this the right thing to do? Is it? I mean, think about the lie detector that you take for certain job interviews.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this would be the ultimate detector. I mean, is anybody on the planet willing to subject all of their thoughts to the analysis of another? I don't think it's a fair thing to do. I don't think it's a fair thing to ask. And more importantly, it should not be imposed on anyone. And that's where the technology is today and where it's headed by government's admission as to what are their goals. I mean, even in the Wired article, their goals are to communicate with each other, but then also to perhaps influence the adversary. And, you know, when your own troops aren't behaving in the way you want, what will be the temptation to manipulate them into doing what they're told or doing what they're directed to do without being?
And sadly, if they can't control it and manipulate it, they will.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, even look at coming out of the Gulf War. One of the guises of mind-altering experiences is because of all of the trauma of war, especially when you're sending people, you know, three and four tours, they come back and they're devastated. because people aren't meant to kill each other on a wholesale basis, and it has an effect on you. So they've been developing drugs and other methods for blanking out part of your memory, so you won't have the traumatic stress syndromes that go with it. The problem is, perhaps this just drives it deeper, you know. And the other problem is, what else are they going to wipe out that you might want to report to someone at a higher command or report to civilian authorities for obvious reasons? And this is where the danger again lies, is we're solving perhaps one problem and then at the same time providing cover for maybe much more significant problems.
All right, let's go back to the calls. We'll go to Anchorage, Alaska, out near your neck of the woods. Let's go to you, Richard. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi, Richard.
Hi, gentlemen. I am so glad to be on tonight because I'm tired of listening to you struggle with all these different guests about how things operate and stuff like that in the universe. And I can only suggest that you read Three Magic Words by U.S. Anderson.
I already did, back when I was 23 years old.
Then that explains about how a lot of this stuff in the universe works, the universal mind and stuff like that, right?
Well, it does in the way we perceive it, but it doesn't the way science perceives it.
Thing is you're trying to live in a dualistic world, okay?
True.
If you try to live in the universal conscious mind, then you'll perceive it better. But another set of books that you should read that takes it another level further is Life and Teachings of the Masters of the Far East.
Have not read that one.
Well, there's six small books that are in a little, comes in a set or whatever. You can get them individually, I think, if you want. But you get them in a set, and I promise you, this will blow your mind. Okay, especially if, I think what you ought to do is read the other one again first. And I'll bet you, by the time you're done with all these books, you will have a lot of your guests, like Mick, read these also. Because, trust me, it's going to change your whole level of consciousness and the way you look and perceive everything. You know what I mean?
Have you read any of these, Nick?
I haven't read these. I made a note of them as Richard was mentioning them. And, you know, I think there's a lot in the esoteric literature that, you know, it's explained in terms that are associated with religion or metaphysics. But they're really the same things that science is saying with a different set of words to describe the same kind of observations. In fact, I was in a conference in the Black Sea region a number of years ago, and the conclusion of religious leaders was sponsored by the Orthodox Church, and they brought together scientists, politicians, business people. And the one thing that came out was that perhaps a religion and science should not have separated in the Dark Ages, that perhaps keeping the view and the ethics and values of religion embedded in science might have been useful. It might have actually opened our eyes to things that otherwise we deny. And I think what Richard is saying is, you know, the dualism, you know, and even in this conversation today, you know, kind of characterizing good and bad use of technology. And I think I understand what Richard is saying is universally, you know, was it good or was it bad? I think we only know at the end of the trail. And as I said, most of our most important experiences occur in terms of life-changing experiences when we would interpret the situation as bad. Out of that comes something quite different. You know, I can think of my own life. You know, the loss of my dad when I was a young teenager was traumatic in one sense, but it was totally life-altering. In fact, I attribute it to changing my life in a very positive way. So, you know, even though the trauma of the event might be bad, the effect of the event might be good. And I think universally, you know, maybe we should start to look at things from that perspective.
Three Magic Words, Power, Peace, Plenty, a classic when I read it a long time ago. Chris in Madison, Wisconsin, east of the Rockies. Hi, Chris.
Good evening. Happy birthday, George.
Thanks, Chris.
Is there anything? I got two questions, actually. Is there anything being done with twins? And there was a movie that came out in the late 70s, maybe early 80s, called Scanners, where two guys that could use their mind real well to cause pain or to torture a person. Do you see that ever happening?
this gets to the issue that that George was talking about, is maybe we'll end up moving objects or using telekinesis as a weapon, you know, weaponized capacity. That is spoken about in the military literature, and you know, I've seen it in a couple of different places. You know, you think about the remote viewing experiments that went on, which was trying to create the ultimate spy on one hand. I think when you look at sort of the breadth of what they were involved in and all of these projects, I think the recognition that we are much, much more than we think as human beings, and that perhaps, and I believe we do, all of us have these capabilities, we just shut them down. I mean, we do it with our own conscious belief in the what's possible and what's impossible. I think that's a big part of it. But things change over time. I mean, when you look at just in 100 years, how much has changed. I mean, 100 years ago, there was less than 10,000 automobiles in the world. Things that would have been absolute science fiction 100 years ago today are common and real and understood by elementary school students. So you know, I think time changes our perception of our reality. But it's we that change, not the fact that we have these capacities. I think we change in our recognition of them. Some people spend years under the guise of religion or metaphysics or other vehicles to get there, but I think science is getting us there as well. The devices that have been developed for enhancing human performance already take us a great deal of the distance, and I think we're going to see much, much more.
British Columbia, we go on the international line. Lorianne, you're up with us.
Hi, good evening.
Good evening.
Good morning. Happy birthday, George.
Thanks, Laura.
I was just wondering how you feel about first impressions, and do you believe in coincidence?
Well, I don't believe in coincidence. I believe in that things don't happen so much by accident. I believe in synchronicity, the idea that things kind of synchronize and line up, and it's the way my life has run pretty much, and I think now 50 years of it, I think it's more than coincidence. The other part of that was, you'll have to tell me again. Excuse me?
First impressions?
Oh, yeah, first impressions. You know, I'll tell you, my wife and I, when we first got into this work, one of the things that we set out was a general rule, because we believe in those first impressions, is when we have them, we act on them, and we listen to them. And it means that we walk away from a lot of conversations politely, but we walk away from them because we respond to that first impression. And I think that's that that telepathic bridge where there's something amiss or something not right. The way I look at it is there's billions and billions of people in the world that I don't have that feeling about. The few instances when I do, I'm better off walking away, because any time so I haven't, I've lived to regret it. and I think first impressions are part of that initial exchange of energy between two parties, that there's actually a great deal of being communicated in those instances.
Okay, thanks, Lori. And next up, let's go to Bill in Spokane, Washington, west of the Rockies. Hi, Bill.
Hello, George. My question is, first part of it is to you, George.
Okay.
It has to do with Michael Savage.
Yeah.
And the whole problem with him being banned from going to Europe and England because of some kind of communications between the British government and the some organization here in America called Media Matters, controlled by George Soros or someone like that. What's your have any take on this first?
Not tonight, not with Nick Begich as a guest, so go with your question.
Well, my question is, if you can control, like, talk radio as opposed to going after the, you know, television networks, would that be a way that these, you know, mind control or whatever would be a more sophisticated plan for them to do?
Well, I guess he's trying to say, can you control talk radio? And if you do, what do we do to control the mind, Nick?
Well, you know, actually, you know, any electronic carrier, you can embed a signal. In fact, on radio, they use this in the first Gulf War, according to Scottish press reports. In the first Gulf War, we used a an aircraft C-130 in a project called Project Solo, which was designed to create propaganda and do different things. But one of the things that they did, as Scottish media reported, was the radio broadcasts that were broadcasting the Muslim music and prayers going into the region. They embedded a signal. In other words, from the C-130 platform, they placed a signal on that radio broadcast that created anxiety and fear on the part of any listeners. And so what we saw in the first Gulf War was the fourth largest army in the world giving up like children on their first fire drill. It was just unprecedented. Nothing like that had ever happened before. But the radio was the carrier, and it was below the level of understanding, so they were just listening to what they normally listen to, and all of these folks, or the vast majority of them, had this dis-ease, this uneasiness, this worry, this fear that was so overwhelming it compelled them to surrender en masse. That can be done. In fact, Perimeters, in an article at the U.S. Army War College called The Mind Has No Firewalls, said exactly that you could use any of these carriers. They talked about a lot of other ways to affect human behavior, but any carrier, TV, radio, power grids, telephone networks, internet, all of these things can be used.
What's the name of the game, though, Nick? What do they want with all this?
I think a couple of things. Firstly, it is about control. I mean, from the military's perspective, who gets there first is really important. And when you think about information warfare, and we hear a lot about that these days, this is the ultimate version of it. When you think about you want to debilitate a government, this is where you would spend a good deal of your money and time. In fact, if you look at Chinese efforts in information warfare, it's probably one of the single biggest expenditures in their military. And people underestimate the Chinese military expenditures because they're quantified in dollars of around 70 billion, which, in U.S. terms is 10% of what we spend. But you get 10 times more productivity in China. You get top-notch scientists for a few thousand bucks.
Exactly.
You get the most brilliant out of a pool of a billion people to choose from that are still routed in central governments to the appropriate educational vehicles to exploit their maximum potentials of their most brilliant people. And so information warfare is a big deal, and you're going to hear a lot more about it in this administration than we've ever heard before, because Chinese information warfare has gotten sophisticated enough where they hacked through the Joint Chiefs of Staff's email a number of years ago. If you look,
And they still do it, Nick.
And they still do it. Now, I have software that was designed and built by a group of technicians in the U.S. and overseas, and we found embedded in my software a table in Chinese characters. And I would venture a guess that every commercial site that can be hacked has been hacked and has a sleeper program sitting in them, and that's what ours was. It was a sleeper program. It wasn't hacked. It wasn't stealing any data. And the way our data was secured, it couldn't do anything there, but it could disrupt our site at some point. We took it out and put in different firewalls, and it hasn't reappeared. But it got me to thinking about civilian sector penetration of this type of technology. You look at power grids, phone companies, banks, the things that make countries run. If you could disable those, you can see the effect. But if you could overwhelm a population by using the very technology they depend on as the carrier for signals that would influence a population, that would even be more devastating and less detectable. In fact, it was the Morrises were in a TV special on mind control with me that was aired in Canada on a program called Undercurrents, and they were involved in the Reagan White House and developing exotic weapon systems. And what they said is that because of the technology and the state of the technology, and this is going back to the 90s when we did this segment, we could embed on all electronic devices a microcircuit that would screen out these carriers, that would screen out these signals, because we knew enough then about what they were to be able to pick them out of sort of the lineup and move them off the screen. And instead, in the 90s, if you recall, we were hearing statements about the opposite kind of a chip, one that could come into your computer only, of course, with a government warrant, and anybody who believed that then certainly doesn't believe that now. And so the technology has been around, the capability has been around, the temptation to use it is always succumbed to, unfortunately, by government.
Okay, stay with us. We'll be back with final phone calls with Nick Begich in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. $4 million might not seem like a lot of money considering what they give out during this stimulus moment of our lives, but that's still a pretty good chunk for some telepathy research, isn't it, Nick?
It is, and you have to remember all research is compartmentalized, so it represents, you know, a small amount of a much bigger project. And they'd already spent $4 million. They're spending another $4 million. If you start to look at all the ancillary projects that could feed into this, whether it's computer science, brain modeling, you know, all the various pieces of this puzzle that have been out on RFPs in the past, then you start to look at the bigger picture on the full costs of these kinds of programs. And, you know, everything is built upon the experience of the past. And these programs have been going on now for decades, as well as a huge amount of civilian research in neuroscience all over the world. And so what we're filling in is sort of the blanks. And so it doesn't require, you know, billions. It requires millions to fill in the blanks. And some things people have just been waiting for computing power to build, to be powerful enough, imaging to be powerful enough in order to, you know, sort of execute what people know is sort of the next steps. And we're there now. And we're quickly approaching a place where everything will change. And here's sort of the race is if, as an example, quantum computers we mention a lot because they will change everything. As fundamentally as the last 100 years has changed everything, quantum computer will change everything in a year or two. And because what will happen then, whoever gets there first, not just understanding the human mind and being able to mediate and interact with it directly, but consider encryption systems, personal privacy, all the systems that rely on complexity in order to be undiscovered. That's why encryption works. It's so complex, computing power isn't there to sort it out. Quantum computers will allow us to sort all of that out, which means encryption goes out the window, which means every system can be hacked, which means the kinds of efforts that we're talking about today can become real for vast segments of the population in not just dealing with emotional states, but dealing with the more complex ideas that are being put forward by DARPA today, which is the idea of really interpreting on a word-by-word basis what's going on within the human mind.
What could go wrong, Nick, with this kind of work and research?
Well, the first things that jump out is one of the things that is looked at is our troop enhancement. In other words, getting people ready for war means that you have to prepare them for the kinds of experiences they're going to have. If you do this effectively, you will effectively numb individual consciousness to the point where they will accept certain things and won't give it a second thought. This is dangerous. The other area is when you go below the level of consciousness, where you're programming an individual on a subconscious level. The problem there is if you drop a thought in that directly conflicts with a root belief at the subconscious level, that's sort of the root of a lot of psychosis in the world today, is these conflicts and belief systems at that level where you never get to play them out in consciousness. And so that becomes a risk. One of the other things that sort of grows out of the military side of this is, you know, where are the civilian applications? Well, when you think about sort of the super learning applications of this technology, that gets pretty exciting to a lot of people. The idea that you might be able to literally download huge amounts of information directly into a human brain at some time in the not too distant future. In other words, like programming, sliding a new disk into your computer and gathering huge amounts of data. Think about that in the context of public education as an example, where compulsory education takes place, some governmental group designs a curriculum and feeds it to your children through the normal educational method. That's one thing, because your kids are, you know, trained by you and you can teach them to discern, to sort out But when you look at these kinds of learning systems, all of that goes out the window. It literally is programming. That's a huge danger. It takes out the critical kind of thinking that makes individuals great and that makes countries great.
Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Biloxi, Mississippi. Jeff, you're up with us. Hi.
Hello. My name is Jeff, and I had a question for your guest, if he's ever heard of Elwood Norris.
Elwood Norris. Yes, that's Woody Norris.
Woody Norris, yes.
Okay, well, I had an article I cut out of the paper years ago where he invented a little speaker and it projected sound into the person's head.
Right.
And they heard, like, the sound of a waterfall.
Yeah, genius.
Yeah, and Woody Norris got the Lemelson MIT Prize for that. In fact, we mention it in the book, Controlling the Human Mind. It was so affirming because, you know, we had talked about this technology for years. We had demonstrated something that required a physical contact, but Elwood or Woody Norris did it without any physical contact using acoustic heterodyning, and that's exactly what he did. He actually then got a military contract to provide perimeter security using the same kind of technology, but in that case, as a warning system to people that entered certain perimeters.
So is it projected? I got a kind of a technical question. I don't really know. Is it projected over a sound wave, or does it use light as a carrier wave with it?
My understanding is they're using a sound wave. That there are other patents that suggest you could carry an auditory signal on a laser, as an example, or on other virtually any other carrier. How that would mechanically work, I'm not exactly clear, but I have seen in the literature. In fact, we cited, I think, over 30 different patents showing gradations of this technology in the book Controlling the Human Mind.
Also, I was going to ask you, do you ever think, I mean, this might be a wild thought, but that we are trying to catch up with things that we once possessed a long time ago or had the capabilities of?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, it would certainly go a long way in explaining a lot of things. I think perhaps that is true. In the area of, I'll give you a good example, is, and I've used this in lectures before, they discovered in the Alps, it was in Italy or Germany, depending on who you want to believe, and it was the Iceman. And the Iceman was 5,000 years old, European, obviously. When they did the autopsy, they found that he had acupuncture tattoos on the acupuncture meridians and points all over his body. They did the autopsy, and it turns out that he had ailments that lined up with all of that. And so they were talking about, well, gee, you know, how did acupuncture get, you know, from China to Europe 5,000 years ago? And what I have said is my theory, and I want to say this really loudly because facts are different than theories. My theory is that the shaman of those ages, without all of the electronic interference and other background noise, literally could see it or sense those energy meridians, which now can be measured. There's devices that I've demonstrated in lectures where you can pick out every acupuncture point on the body by picking up the electromagnetic signal that it creates. Well, I think that at one point in time, man was much more sensitive and capable in this area, and perhaps we are rediscovering what was once generally known, or at least at some level understood.
I think things are getting kind of scrambled. How do you decipher if it's an angel or aliens or the government?
Well, this is this is that whole area of discernment. I think that's the age that we're in. What is real now and what isn't real becomes a little bit confusing. I'll give you another good example when you talk about the dangers of these areas. Imagine one of the capabilities that the military has looked for is creating or deleting memory sets in individuals. In other words, we've heard about it for trauma, where they want to get rid of those bad memories so people don't have that trauma, but then also giving you new memory or giving you new information. At some point, imagine going into a trial in a court where somebody is recollecting something that they never experienced. How would you discern that? Right now, there's no clear way of how you could discern it. Their testimony, they would swear to it. They would have, in their own mind, experienced it, and yet the events never occurred. These technologies in the neurosciences are going to change so much, so dramatically, the very way in which we view privacy, justice, what a human being is, are going to be challenged in this generation, in our generation.
Okay, thanks, Nick. Let's go to... Kelowna, British Columbia. Claudia, wildcard line.
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, George. Nick, this is a privilege. I'd like to switch tracks just a bit onto the chemtrails and the HAARP. And I first heard about the chemtrails on your program, George, and I have to admit I was a skeptic until last spring. And, I mean, these things are getting so much worse. I'd like to ask Nick, how are these people getting away with this, and who's going to stop these madmen? I mean, I've watched... I'm really energy sensitive, so I know exactly what you're talking about, Nick, when you're talking about HAARP. And in this last year, I've learned to differentiate between the chemtrail symptoms, which for me are purely physical. They're the sinus, the digestive, the headaches, which I've never had before in my life. But when they start HAARPing us, I get really terrible anxiety right in my solar plexus area. It's like an overwhelming fear, and it disrupts my sleep. I feel like it's also cutting off access to the etheric energy, the positive energy flow that I've had most of my life. I mean, I've always been able to access that, and I'm sure that it's HAARP. In mid-January this year, there was a very brutal two-week chemtrail HAARP attack, and I watched our predominant overwintering birds, which happened to be the sparrows. They were wiped out. My husband came home every afternoon, and we would have dead, staggering sparrows in our backyard.
Mm.
Some of them were in the birdhouse, dead, with their heads hanging out. It was horrible. They're still gone. Is there a chance that this is going to stop at some point?
Well, you know, on the chemtrails, there's a lot of other folks covering that story. I have not been covering it. In terms of interference, I think you hit a very important point, is all of this background noise, especially these huge systems now that are being experimented with, I think they do interfere. In fact, in general stress levels and anxiety, you can target any organ of the human body with a specific signal and disrupt it, whether you want to affect the liver, the lungs, the kidneys. You can do this. You can do it deliberately. But the other issue that comes up is how much is done accidentally or as a side effect of our technologies. It's not really being looked at. Stress is a prime example. It leads to a tremendous amount of illness, cardiovascular disease, heart disease, mental disorders, et cetera, related to stress. And yet, if you go into a room in an urban area, you are surrounded by a 60-cycle power grid that is an agitating grid. If you go and kill the breaker to your house, not the circuit breakers, but the total power breaker to your house, you will immediately notice not just the silence, but your whole body contracts, it relaxes, it stops making up for the background noise, if you will. And I think that as our society has gotten more sophisticated in one way, we are impacting us as human beings. We're being impacted much more severely. When you get out into the country, you notice it right away. Everything's quiet is the first thing, but then you notice this general sense of tension is gone from the body. New Yorkers often end up back in New York City because they're uncomfortable when they're outside of that buzz, if you will, and it literally is that. It is a low level of energy in terms of magnitude. It's not really intense, but it has a tremendous drain on the physical body.
Okay, thanks, Nick. Next up, let's go to Michael in Joshua Tree, California, west of the Rockies. Hi, Michael.
Hey, happy birthday, George.
Thanks, Michael.
Nick, interesting, beautiful, and totally enlightening. The young lady was saying chemtrails, and try to explain this to a bunch of college students, what we're talking about tonight. They just tell you, why don't you go over there and mind yourself. I had a question for you and a comment. I remember the last time that you were on the show, you were going to discuss how to create a white noise gate or a way to reflect or to stop or impede ELFs through an apparatus, but you never got through that. That's my first comment. My second one is, do you think that living near military bases, they radiate certain frequencies to keep populace at a certain, let's just say, controlled distance? And I'll take my answer off the phone unless you have a question for me.
I appreciate it. You know, the show that you had heard was a repeat, and it was actually the very first show I believe that I did with Art Bell, and it was in December of, I think it was 94 or 95. It was quite a while ago, and it was replayed about a month or two ago.
That's right.
And we had talked about the perhaps the ability to create a circuit that would allow you to sort of disregard the background noise. But in the years since then, I can say there is no single system that will do the job, because any of these carriers, you can guard against one thing, and all you end up doing is another carrier can be used. In other words, you can block your computers with microcircuits or other devices, but then you've got your television, your radio, your power grid. There's no real simple answer to that. The one thing that we do know is that you tend to lock on to the stronger signal. And so the idea was is to create a signal generator that would create, say, a signal at, say, 8 hertz, which would be the lower end of your alpha range, or that sort of zone where people are when they're doing really creative and intellectual work. You would set up your environment to pulsate at, say, 8 or 9 hertz, where the body would lock onto that signal and disregard these less powerful signals in the background. And the theory is still good. Still useful, but even that becomes somewhat imposing, because then you're sort of locking yourself in to an unnatural rhythm, because you experience the alpha rhythms periodically, you know, through the day and night, but not on a consistent, constant basis, although some people attempt to do that. The other question was on military bases. I don't know whether you're subjected to this kind of technology. It wouldn't surprise me in some cases. But probably more importantly, the communication and broadcast systems that create an incredible amount of electromagnetic energy, depending on what they're using and what bases, that can have a much greater effect on people than we once thought. The amount of energy required to affect human health, we're learning, and it's finally being acknowledged, that it's not the intensity of the signal, but it's what the signal is actually doing, the broadcast frequencies. And this is where complex signals interacting with others then create these tertiary signals that have even unexpected effects. And this gets complicated, but the general net effect of it is a highly stressed out urbanized society that's as stressed out because of the technologies as we are of all of the other sort of events that happen in life.
Nick, are you glad that they're perfecting telepathy like this?
In one sense, it's a signal, because it tells me that we're probably on the verge of getting there anyway on our own. It bothers me that DARPA is involved in this. It bothers me because of their mission. And I don't want to be critical of the military, because they have a very important mission. But the reason that the military is sort of put in the box of being controlled by the civilian sector is, otherwise, the mission overtakes the population. And I think that's where we're at today.
Let's come back with final calls with you when we roll along on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, we're with Nick Begich. His website, by the way, earthpulse.com. Is your book, Controlling the Human Mind, available still, Nick?
Yeah, it is. It's available on the website, and of course, Amazon has it as well. And I think all of our books are posted on the Coast to Coast AM site.
Oh, absolutely. When do we run into you at another conference?
I don't know. You know, I've kind of cut back on my my lecturing. You know, we've got so much going on here in Alaska, and trying to keep up with everyone. And I haven't scheduled anything for this year. I took the year and I've really focused on family and trying to do a little bit more with radio and reaching a lot more folks. And it's just been a very, very hectic time. But I'm hoping that I'll be back out lecturing in 2010 and get out in a few places. I know we run into each other from time to time. And that's always great to see you and part of your team.
Absolutely. How's your brother doing?
He is doing really well. In fact, I was back in D.C., just a couple months ago on some business and had a chance to see him in action back there. And you know, he's a new U.S. senator for people that don't know, and Mark is representing Alaska in the U.S. Senate. And so we look for a lot of good things from Mark, and as a freshman, he's got to learn a lot, and hopefully in the next couple of years, we'll be able to get some of these issues addressed as he anchors himself in the Senate and finds his place there in the appropriate committees.
I was thinking of your father after this Air France crash, Nick. The similarities of just the disappearance.
Yep.
And they could never find them.
Yep. And, you know, when Dad was in the Congress and that occurred, it's one of these things I feel every time I hear about an airplane being lost, and because I do know what the families have gone through and are going through. It's a difficult thing, and at the same time, it is a life-changing event for those that remain behind. And as tough as it was, for my family, I can certainly identify and hope that there's still a chance for recovery. I mean, for us, they never recovered anything. They never found the wreckage officially. So you wondered, you kind of left wondering. Alaska's a vast place, and people have walked out months after being gone, but after this many years, pretty impossible.
Okay, back to the calls we go. Hardwick, Minnesota, first-time caller. Hello, John, go ahead.
Hi, gentlemen.
Hi.
I'm listening to you on 570 WNAX, but I had a quick comment about an experience that I have and then a question, if I could, real quick. Whenever I lay down to go to sleep, if I lay on my right side, I mean, it's like a fast-forward movie. Everything that I've done, seen, not in any particular order. I mean, just constantly, and real vivid. But if I lay on my left side, I can't even make myself get a vision or a thought. I was wondering if your guests have any idea what that would be with one.
There are different techniques, Nick, and relaxing techniques.
Certainly. In fact, relaxation for vividly, getting impressions or intuitive thoughts. Relaxation is a big part of that. In fact, one of the callers, and I meant to cover this, talked about, getting stressed. Well, you can't reach your higher states of consciousness under stress because they require a slowing of the mind, a slowing of the brain into these slower rhythms until you get down to the deep sleep rhythms of delta, which run from a fraction of a hertz or a pulse per second up to around three or four pulses per second. Theta, which is between awake and asleep, is 3 to 7, and then 7 to 12 approximately is your alpha waking state, concentration state.
Because the only time that I can sleep is if I lay on my left side. I fall asleep right away.
Yeah, I can't explain it. I mean, sometimes it's just an individual preference.
Right, creature of habit.
Yeah, I don't know what the underlying physical mechanism would be that would cause that. But again, the brain is a complex thing, and each of us are very complex, and we are individuals. I mean, certain things will affect us in certain ways and not others. A lot of that has to do with our metabolism, our body type, the very shape of our body, in fact, and how we operate as a transducer of energy. So these things vary from person to person.
Where do you see the applications, military or in civilian type use of this telepathy?
The civilian uses are kind of interesting. I mean, I thought about this. What would happen if human beings all of a sudden had this capacity? Well, a couple things would occur, and I've said this before in lectures. Firstly, you better be able to forgive yourself and others because once you're made fully transparent, it's really like Judgment Day. It's everything's laid before you in terms of your life. If we all had that capability, it would require a very different kind of personality to navigate that world and to do it in a respectful way. And I think that's, maybe that is Judgment Day. Maybe the day that we recognize our own potentials as created human beings and we gain these capabilities, perhaps that in that awakening comes the gnashing of teeth that we all have read about.
Could be. Next up, let's go to Mira Loma, California, west of the Rockies. Kim, you're on with Nick Begich on Coast.
Hi, happy birthday, George.
Thank you, Nick.
Jerry Purnell says hi.
Good friend. Man. Thanks, Kim.
And right from that, Jerry Purnell and Larry Niven in a novel about 30 years ago called Oath of Fealty postulated basically computer-based electronic telepathy and how it would change a society. I'd highly recommend to anybody who wants to explore the possible ramifications of that, still in print. And in addition, I'm wondering if you are familiar with the case in India last year where a woman was convicted of murder and sentenced to life in prison on the basis of a brain scan.
Well, I hadn't seen that. I know that there's been discussion of this, you know, in terms of, because if you're questioned and certain parts of the brain light up.
That's exactly what they did.
And then you can use that. If it, maybe not in U.S. courts because it hasn't been proven as a scientific method, but if India has accepted it as a scientific method and allowed it as evidence, that's pretty convincing. Now,
the
problem is, how accurate is it? Do we have enough data to really make those kind of conclusions? And this is, again, when you go back to the very beginning of the show tonight, that's what DARPA is looking for, those generalizations that would allow us with some level of certainty to know literally the thoughts of another.
Well, I had an interesting experience. Without going into the details, I was in Army intelligence for a few years, and we used lie detectors, polygraphs.
Right.
And I had an experience where we were just experimenting on each other. We were interrogators and counterintelligence people, learning how the machines worked with expert operators. And we had an experience where another soldier who I knew fairly well, female, she was on the polygraph, and I was interrogating her, and I locked eyes with her, and the polygraph went crazy.
Hmm.
And the operator said he'd never seen anything like it before, and at that moment, I knew the next thing she was going to say. I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was one of those things where if I had wanted to, I could have done what we've all experienced. I could have said exactly the words she said as she said them.
Probably said, marry me.
It could have been. And then one last thing, and I'll let you go to the next caller. Two books that I would highly recommend, and I wonder if you're familiar with them. One is Your Friend Who Had the Telepathic Power. It reminds me very much of the lead character in Robert Silverberg's early 70s novel, Dying Inside. Which is about a telepath and how he's losing his mind because he's losing the ability to read minds. And he undergoes a nervous breakdown because he uses it as a crutch, almost the opposite of your character. But there seem odd resonances between the two, the way they deal with having this power. And the other one was Joe Haldeman, another science fiction writer, wrote a book 10 years ago in 1998 called Forever Peace, where he postulated computer-based electronic telepathy between soldiers fighting a war. And the soldiers rebelled and realized that if they linked human beings together for a long period of time telepathically, they would lose the ability to be warriors. They could no longer harm another human being. And they began to do this to all the other soldiers and then to do it all to all these people on Earth. And I wonder if you've ever read that novel and if you think the idea was that we would develop such deep empathy from knowing another human being at every level that we would be unable to harm another human being.
You know, I think fundamentally this is, it does go against our nature. As far as fiction reading, I just don't do any of it. I had to read 3 fiction books in high school in order to get through a course, and that was the last fiction I read. At least I think it was the last fiction I read.
I have a friend like you. Also, one last thing. I highly recommend the book by Stephen Wolfram on Conrad Zuse's concept of calculating space, which is, I don't know if you're familiar, that the universe is actually, it's called digital physics. It's a branch of philosophy that says the universe actually runs on a grid of computers. Zuse was an early computer scientist in Germany, died about 10 years ago. He built computers during World War II on his own. Complete genius. And digital physics postulates that all the laws of the universe are just basically running on a giant grid of quantum computers. And there's no physical evidence that it's not true. And Stephen Wolfram wrote a book called A New Kind of Science. If you could ever get him as a guest, I'd highly recommend him. He's a fascinating character. And I'll let you go. Thanks.
Yeah, New Kind of Science is excellent. And you know, there's a lot of interesting thinking happening today. And I think that's the other side of all of this is the good news is people are linked. When you think of the internet, it's a connection of people on a physical level. There was a deal done on PBS a while back, and it was called the World Wide Mind, and their speculation that eventually, just like the internet connected people in one way, there'll be the next connection, which is all the minds of human beings connected together. I think we already are. We just don't realize it in sort of the open sense where we quantify it. I think that's already going on at some level. Man will eventually get to the point where we can demonstrate it physically, and then that means we could also control it, and that's wherein lie the risk with these things. Advancing the knowledge of neuroscience for the benefit of humankind is the hope, but the recognition that only a vigilant population will make sure that is the outcome.
Okay, let's go to Nashville, Tennessee, east of the Rockies. Ed, go ahead.
Hey, George, happy birthday. I hope you have 50 more.
Thanks.
I'm about your age, so maybe I can get that many, too. Hey, look, hang on to your seat. Remember what you've been talking about the last couple months, the New World Order. Can you imagine this deal you were talking about the last half hour?
Oh.
With yahoos, with all these rich people that got no mind or, you know, have no kind of, you know, sense of self or anything else. I mean, all they want is greed. And, I mean, they'd be leading us around like a bunch of sheep.
Well, I think you raise a good point, and you know the elites of the world, you know, certainly want to be insulated from this technology. At the same time, you can certainly see how it could be abused. A simple system was used in Japan a number of years ago, and we cite the patents where they used in seven languages at a subliminal level. While they were playing the background music in department stores, they were giving messages to not steal. Now, that was a 40% reduction in shoplifting that occurred in that marketplace. Now, could you imagine if the fluorescent orange socks with the green stripes in aisle 6 weren't selling, what you could also do with this technology?
Well, actually, believe it or not, Walmart has been using that back about 10 years ago. They did something similar to it.
They've talked about it. In fact, they've even talked about putting an area in the store where, as a novelty, you can kind of roll by and hear the voice in the head. There's been some of that discussion. I think in some stores they may have even affected that. The point is, it's all part of that sort of general conditioning of the population to accept without much questioning these innovations. I think we need to question the innovations and the use of the technology if we're going to maintain a free society. A free society that's based on individuals, not based on a squishy kind of collective.
I think actually what we really need to do is where the House and Senate congregate, do a mind thing where they can tell them to use common sense, do things for the people, not for themselves. You know, let the people govern themselves.
Well, it would be good. I mean, we got a long way to go to get back to where we started, and I guess that's really what the challenge is. You know, things were much simpler a couple hundred years ago in a lot of respects. And this is where, again, all of us as average citizens need to engage our political processes more fully. We don't have to be experts on technology any more than we are experts at fixing our automobiles today. But we can certainly drive them from place to place. And the technologies of this century, the population of this century needs to drive, and not the elites of the world, whether it's a New World Order elite or what I would call an old world order elite.
Let's go first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yeah, hi. My name's Mike.
Hey, Mike. Go ahead.
Well, I was actually wanted to comment on the telepathy thing.
Sure.
When I was a kid, I had a dream where I'd see a place and people, hear conversations, and a couple days later, the exact same thing. So I know precognition has to be at least possible to some extent. And he was talking about dreams earlier, and sleeping. What if, has anyone looked into using lucid dreaming to try to tap into some of these abilities?
That's a good question, Nick.
Yeah, actually, they have. In fact, light and sound devices, and you can see a few of them on our website, have actually stimulated those kinds of effects in people. And light and sound devices use binaural beat and flickering light to create altered states of consciousness for accelerated learning, relaxation, meditation, and also altered states. And so, yes, the technology is already there. It's available. We make it available to people so they can experiment with it. Light and sound devices have been around for at least 25 years that I'm aware of, where they've been commercially available. biofeedback devices of various kinds for training the brain so that you can enhance certain human functions. Those have been around for decades. We carry some of those pieces of equipment on our website. But these are the kinds of things that I'm personally interested in, because this is where the rubber meets the road. If you can enhance your own human potential to use the creativity, to use the capacity that you already have, your reliance on externals for that becomes somewhat lessened. And this is where, again, I think that humankind will hit this next evolutionary leap, this next jump to our to maybe our higher states of consciousness. But remember, those higher states aren't faster and bigger and more powerful. They're subtle, they're light, they're soft, and they're less of a frequency, a softer tone, if you will, a more relaxed place. And from there, we can become more creative. And we have just the opposite surrounding us virtually every day.
What's the capacity of the human mind?
I don't think we've ever found it.
It's not been pushed, has it?
No, I don't think we've ever pushed it. We've seen brilliant, brilliant minds. We've seen some incredibly creative people in all walks of life. But I don't think any of those people would ever have said they hit their threshold or even got close to it. And I think that's the challenge. I think we all have that capability. And the challenges of the neuroscience isn't to figure out how to control people, but it should be focused on how to release us to our higher capacities.
Did the ancients practice this, Nick?
I think so. I think that a lot of the mysteries that are still classified as mysteries, or what we might even call magic, because we can't understand it, will eventually be explained. And it'll be explained through the laws of physics and laws we have yet to discover. But I believe the ancients understood sound and its effect on objects, understood the capacity of the mind, and actually exercised it.
Fantastic. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.